Hi, this is Pastor Matt, and I want to welcome you to our Blue Oaks Church podcast. At the end of this episode, feel free to download our Blue Oaks Church app, where you'll be able to access resources, events, and ways to get connected at Blue Oaks and in the community. The app is the easiest way to share this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around Blue Oaks. Most importantly, though, I just hope that you enjoy this episode and it inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey.
Good morning. How you doing? We've been talking in this series about what happens when something inside of us quietly takes the wheel. We've talked about anger and worry and desire. And today we're going to talk about one of the hardest things to see, and that is pride. You know, anger feels dangerous. Worry feels exhausting. Desire feels hungry. Pride feels right. It feels like clarity. It feels like discernment. It feels like moral strength, which is why it's so dangerous. Pride is the only hijacker that will convince us that we're still at the wheel. And that's what Jesus addresses in one of the most unforgettable parables, a story about two men who go to pray, and only one of them really connects with God. It's in Luke 18, if you want to turn there and follow along. Let's read it together. Luke 18, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And for us to understand this story, it's critical to notice who the audience is. Take a look again at verse 9. To some, and then this remarkable statement, who were confident of their own righteousness. They knew they were righteous and looked down on everyone else. Now, part of what Jesus came to do was to redefine true righteousness. And at the heart of authentic righteousness, as Jesus came to explain it, is a heart that genuinely loves God and genuinely loves people. That's the essence of righteousness. That's like the bottom line of righteousness. And here Jesus is talking about people who are quite confident in their own righteousness. And they don't love anyone, and they look down on everyone. And so what we're getting into here is a misunderstanding of righteousness, which is unbelievably important for anyone who wants to pursue spiritual growth. When people get righteousness wrong, it's deadly. Because when righteousness gets distorted, well, pride grabs the wheel and starts steering our lives, our spiritual lives. Now, the crowd Jesus was talking to would have been larger than just one group of people who thought that they were superior. There would be lots of different people in the crowd, but it contains these people who are self-righteous, people who have power and respectability, people who were looked up to as spiritual giants, and that's how they felt about themselves. When they held in contempt the very outcasts and rejects and spiritual zeros that Jesus kept giving himself to and Jesus kept hanging out with. As you read through the Gospels, you notice this particular dynamic, this sense of superiority or self-righteousness drew sharper rebukes from Jesus than any other sin. It really did. An awful lot of sinners flocked to Jesus. Self-righteous people did not flock to Jesus. Have you ever noticed that? People who were guilty of really bad sexual sins and financial sin and so on, they all flocked to Jesus. But the writers of scripture never say self-righteous people flock to Jesus. And so Jesus deliberately tells a parable in a public setting where the character who represents the spiritual giants turns out to be the villain. And the guy who looks like the spiritual zero turns out to be the hero. Now understand, this is not like a pleasant little story that Jesus is telling to a group of his followers. This is like the gauntlet thrown in the face of very powerful religious leaders. Jesus is looking for some serious trouble in this story. And you don't get this story unless you can feel the tension becoming unbearable as Jesus is telling this story. The spiritual giants in this audience are getting so offended that they're ready to kill him. And one day they would for stories like this. On the other hand, spiritual zeros in the crowd, the sinners, they're listening to Jesus with like open mouths. Can you believe that he's saying this? Like a story where the tax collector isn't the butt of the joke, isn't the bad guy. This is unbelievable. Jesus is telling a story where the tax collector is the hero. Like no one tells a story where the tax collector is the hero. No wonder we love this guy. Now, why does Jesus do this? Why does he get so ruthlessly in the face of the most powerful people of his day? I'll tell you why. I think it's because when it comes to pride or superiority, he's dealing with a problem that's uniquely difficult for human beings to recognize in themselves. It's a funny thing. I've been thinking about this a lot this week. People see therapists or people will meet with a pastor like every day for anger problems. Like they know that their resentment can destroy their relationships and people feel guilty about that. And they know that they lash out. And so they go visit therapists and pastors to get help. People who suffer from anxiety and fear, they go to counseling offices every day because they're dying inside and they know it. They're desperate for help. Mismanaged desire and greed and addictions bring millions of desperate people to choices between life and death every day. Millions of desperate people in 12-step groups are ready to confess every detail of their lives every day because they know they're on the road to death. Every one of these problems that we've talked about in this series, mismanaged anger and worry and mismanaged desire, every one of them have treatment centers and research programs that are devoted to overcoming them. Like people buy books and go to classes and listen to podcasts and sermons by the thousands because they're desperate. Here's what's interesting. I've never known any counselor or therapist who had one single person come to them and say they needed help with their pride problem. Because pride is the only hijacker that convinces you you're still driving. Like we know of no Betty Ford Treatment Center for the insufferably arrogant. Which is too bad, isn't it? Like, couldn't our world use a couple of those? You know, the Betty Ford Treatment Center for the insufferably arrogant. Do you know a few people who would be, you'd like to send to those? Yeah. I'll tell you what I think. I think if there was such a place, some of the people who need it most, they would not be Hollywood celebrities. They wouldn't be the Washington power brokers. It would include some of us. It would include a lot of us who call ourselves Christians. Some of us who can so easily complain about the rest of society that isn't as morally upright as we are. See, one of the biggest problems with pride or superiority or judgmentalism is that people suffering from it don't know they're suffering from it. Anger feels hot. Worry feels anxious. Desire feels hungry. Pride feels justified. And when you feel justified, you don't even realize something else has taken control of your life. That's why Jesus attacks it with such brutal honesty in the story. But the sting gets lost over the centuries. Like, think about this. This is so ironic. When the majority of Christians in our day read this parable, you know what most of them think? They think, well, thank God I'm not like the tax collector. Or thank God I'm not like the Pharisee. Thank God I'm not like this Pharisee who said, thank God I'm not like the tax collector. Like Christians in our day read this story and they think that Pharisee thought he could earn favor, earn his way into God's favor, you know, but I'm smarter than he was. My theology is correct. Thank God I'm superior to this guy who thought he was superior. But maybe that Pharisee has a little more to teach us than we realize. So let's kind of put ourselves in the place of Jesus's listeners just for a moment. And the first thing that we have to do, the people listening to Jesus would hear something totally different with this word Pharisee than we hear today. They would hear it totally different. In our day, a Pharisee has become synonymous with self-righteousness and hypocrisy, and we all tend to get quite judgmental about the Pharisees being so judgmental. And to get the point of Jesus' story, you have to erase what you know about Pharisees, okay? Because to Jesus' listeners, Pharisee was actually a very good word. Even in the Gospels, everything we hear about Pharisee is not bad. If you look at Luke 13, Jesus' life is being threatened by Herod Antipas, very violent, aggressive, impulsive ruler. He's after Jesus. And this is quite remarkable. Notice who comes to Jesus' rescue. Luke 13, 31 says, "At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, 'Leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you.'" Now, we know enough about Herod Antipas to know that if he's after an enemy of his and that enemy gets tipped off and gets away, like Herod Antipas is going to want to know who tipped this guy off. At considerable risk to themselves, the people intervene to save Jesus' life are the Pharisees. Nicodemus, who sought Jesus out as a teacher, was also one of the leading Pharisees. Jesus, of course, often criticized the behavior of many among the Pharisees. We don't know what the percentages were, but he would criticize the behavior of many of them. But this is what Jesus said about their teaching in Matthew 23. "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you." Like from Jesus, that's quite a remarkable thing to say about their teaching. So if we're going to benefit from this story, it doesn't work for us to start with a judgmental attitude toward the Pharisees. They were people who Jesus' listeners would have had sincere respect for and looked up to. Tax collectors, on the other hand, they were despised, seen as traitors, the corrupt traitors. If you want to put this in like modern terms, the story would feel something like there was a Habitat for Humanity volunteer and there was a drug dealer. Like it would have that kind of flavor to it. Another detail we need to know, when Jesus says these two men go to the temple to pray, it would have sounded a bit different to his listeners than it sounded to us. We tend to think that they were just having this private experience, that they went to pray on their own. However, his listeners would have understood Jesus to refer to like the daily time of prayer. It was offered once in the morning around 9 a.m. and once in the afternoon around 3 p.m. Many, many people would go to the temple to observe the sacrifice of atonement. At a certain time, they would pray and they would do this out loud. This was like a public act. In other words, this is not like a private deal. This is a public service. The actions and the words of these two men would have taken place in full view of all the people that gathered together in the temple. This is just a public deal. And so Jesus says the Pharisee and the tax collector go to the temple for the daily prayer, for the daily sacrifice. The priest goes in, kills the sacrificial calf, goes inside the holy place to burn incense. And at that point, when the incense start rising, that would have been the symbol for the prayers of God's people to start rising to heaven. And so that would be the time when people would pray. And in their culture, what they would do is they would pray out loud. And so Jesus says the Pharisee stands up to pray. And the Pharisee that Jesus uses in Luke 18 says, the Pharisee stood up by himself and prayed. In other words, he separated himself from the masses of people, because he was a Pharisee. Because if he were to accidentally touch anyone in the crowd who was unclean, that would have defiled him. He was a holy man, and so he separated himself. He prayed by himself. And everyone there would have said, well, of course he's doing that. He's a holy man. Now, usually at this point in the service, it was customary for the sinners, like the tax collector, to be led outside in the temple area in the east gate to pray. Customarily, that's what would have happened. For some reason in this day, that didn't happen. And these defiled people, these sinners like this tax collector, are allowed to hang around. And the Pharisee doesn't like this at all. And so he does an interesting thing with his prayer. And what he does is not just reserved for to people in the first century. Like, have you ever heard someone who technically is praying out loud, but you can tell by the way that they're praying, it's just an excuse to kind of send a message to someone who's listening? Have you ever experienced that kind of thing? Like, oh God, help my husband who's listening right now, even as you and I speak to have victory over his selfish and inconsiderate ways. And to buy a really nice gift for me for my birthday, which, as you know, Lord, is in my shopping cart at Nordstrom.com even now. Like, that person is not really talking to God. Bill Moyer was Lyndon Johnson's press secretary during the 60s, and he was praying one time before a cabinet meeting. And because he was praying kind of quietly, LBJ said to him, "Speak up, Bill, I can hear you." And Moyer said, "Well, that's okay, Mr. President, I wasn't really talking to you." The Pharisee is not really talking to God. He decides to use this prayer as an opportunity to instruct all of the unrighteous people who are around him. Notice at this point how his sense of superiority is really cutting him off from the Spirit of God. He's not really connecting with God in this moment. He thinks he is, but he's not. This is like he's offering a parody of a prayer. Jewish prayers were generally either expressions of thanksgiving for gifts that God had given them or petitions for need. And this guy says, "God, I'm so glad I'm not like all these other men. Thanks that I'm not a robber. Thanks that I don't steal. I'm not an evildoer. I'm not an adulterer. I'm not like this tax collector here." Do you ever find yourself deliberately searching for flaws in another human being? Do you ever find yourself kind of hoping that you can pass judgment on someone else? It's a strange thing. This business of pride or superiority is particularly a problem for people who pursue faith, who pursue virtue. Pride or superiority is a problem for people of faith in a way that is kind of unique compared to resentment or anxiety or fear or appetites or whatever. Because when I try to do something that I think is good, it's a real short step for me to say, what a noble thing I'm doing. How come other people can't do the same thing like I'm doing? Sometimes it happens in just goofy little ways. Let's say I'm working on an appetite problem. I'm a Chick-fil-A-aholic. And so I go on a diet and for like 2 days, I eat really well, but I'm kind of cranky about it. I walk into Chick-fil-A and I order a garden salad and I see people around me eating fried chicken sandwiches smothered with Chick-fil-A sauce and waffle fries. And I start thinking, what's the matter with all these people? Like, how could they be eating all this stuff? Don't they have any self-control at all? Are they just a collection of appetites worshiping at the altar of fried chicken? What's wrong with these people? Even though I was eating the same stuff yesterday and I will be eating the same stuff tomorrow. There's a lot of stuff that I don't think about when I start passing judgment on whoever else for whatever reason. I don't think about the person I'm judging as maybe having a more difficult background than I had. I don't think about the fact that I might have had a whole lot of spiritual and emotional and personal assets on my side that they never had. I don't think about their genetic predispositions and that they might be battling wiring problems that I don't battle. I don't think about 1,000 other ways in which they are far more virtuous and much better people than I am. I just focus on this one area and I get all self-righteous about it. That's pride taking the wheel over something as small as lunch. What a noble thing I'm attempting to do. How come other people can't be more like me? You see, the Pharisee is not really praying at all. He's saying these words publicly, And this is part of the darkness in the story. He's saying these words publicly so that they can be heard by as many people as possible. He's deliberately humiliating this tax collector. He's doing this because it makes him feel good to have thoughts like this. He looks at this tax collector and he looks pretty good by comparison. And it makes him feel like the stab of joy inside, like, I'm better than this guy. I'm more pleasing to God than this guy. It makes him feel good. And so he just keeps comparing himself to this guy. Not only does he not like him, but he says, I fast twice a week, which is kind of an interesting statement. According to Levitical law, Israelites were required to fast once a year on the Day of Atonement. So this guy fasts twice every week. Those of you who are math majors, how many times a year would that be? Take a wild guess. 104. I mean, he's doing some like serious extra credit work, this Pharisee. And he says, I give a tenth of all I get. According to the Old Testament, tithing was to have been already observed on like wine and grain and oil by those who produced it, so farmers and so on. And so it wasn't necessarily required to be fasted or to be tithed on once you receive those goods, because it had already been tithed on. But this guy, he goes ahead and he tithes on it anyway. And then he pays an additional tithe on anything else that comes into his possession. For whatever reason, you're not required to tithe on other products, on other types of produce in that era, like celery. You didn't have to tithe on celery. I'm not making this up. I guess they figured even God doesn't like celery. Like, no one likes celery, so you don't have to tithe on celery. This guy, he tithes on everything. Like stuff that should have already been tithed on, he tithes on it. Stuff that you don't even have to tithe on, he tithes on that. He's not just observing the law. It's like he's doing extra credit work. And he uses the low spiritual reputation of the tax collector to make himself feel better. But he didn't have to do this. He didn't. Like, here's what he could have done. He could have seen that tax collector with all the people around him in the temple, and he could have run over to him, he could have thrown his arms around him, and he could have said, man, I'm so glad you're here. What a great choice you made to be here, to come to the temple, to be reminded during the service that we serve and we follow a merciful God, a sin-forgiving, gracious God. What a great choice you made. I'm so glad that you're here, because you know what? You and I, we're just a couple of the same people who need God's grace. That's who we are. And I'll make you a deal. You pray for me, I'll pray for you. This whole atonement thing is for both of us. And that Pharisee could have opened the door of everyone's heart in that community to this tax collector. He could have been a vessel of God's grace to this tax collector. And if the Spirit was flowing in his life, as the Spirit is available to every one of us today, that's the kind of thing that the Spirit would have prompted him to do. But he didn't do that. He didn't do that because he was too devoted to his own pride. It made him feel good inside to say, I am better than you. Self-righteousness and judgment, like Jesus goes after this stuff like harder than he does anything else, because it cuts me off to the Spirit of God like nothing else does. Because it puts me in the center of my universe. And the moment me is in the center, pride has the wheel. Because it prompts me to violate love. You know, a lot of other sins of the appetite, they're bad. Like, they're devastating. They wound souls. But people sometimes pursue gluttony and other sins of the appetite, and they're still capable of love. Pride is utterly and completely incompatible with love. It's like the opposite of love. The irony here is this Pharisee thinks he's praying. Like, he thinks he's pleasing God. people who are full of resentment, where anger is just flowing out of them like lava, people who are anxious and scared and don't trust God because they're afraid, so they disobey him, people who have all kinds of addictions and impulse problems, they at least they know they have the problem. They generally know how serious their spiritual problem is. But if you ask this Pharisee how his spiritual life was going, what do you think he would have said? Great. My spiritual life is great. I went to the temple today. I was praying. God is so pleased. I'm fasting. I'm tithing. I do extra credit work. Man, my spiritual life is tremendous. And the reality is he was sinning the whole time. He was attacking another person. He was violating love. He was damaging community. He was poisoning his soul. And he didn't even know it. He didn't even have a clue. His practices looked really good to him, and they looked really good to other people, but he was a total mess. And what matters to Jesus and what matters to our Heavenly Father is our lives. And so let me ask you, do you have any of this Pharisee in you? Do you ever find yourself passing judgment on someone else? Do you ever get a little twinge of joy out of being critical? Do you ever find out someone messed up and you feel a little superior? Would you just look at yourself? Would you just like examine your life honestly? I was talking to a friend some time ago, and I was talking about someone who I know pretty well and he knows somewhat. And I was talking about this person in a very judgmental way. I was just expressing all kinds of anger and indignation over this person's character flaws. And my friend made an interesting comment to me. He said, I learned recently that when we feel really judgmental towards someone else, it's often because at some level we envy them. And I said, that's like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. No, I didn't say that. I said, ouch, because I have some of that in me. There are times when it's so easy for me to go through that place. Now, the other character in this story is the tax collector. Tax collectors were universally hated in Israel, and for good reason. They were collaborators with Rome. Israel was occupied by an enemy, and tax collectors sold out their own people for profit to their people's enemy. They were understood to be quite corrupt. Well, Jesus says this tax collector stood at a distance. So he separated himself from the people, but not for the same reason the Pharisee separated himself from the people. He did it because he was aware of who he was inside. He knew he was dangerous to other people. And his awareness of his own fallenness and brokenness produced this deep humility in him. Jesus says he wouldn't even look up to heaven. Heaven is often a Jewish way of speaking about God. You know, we sometimes say if someone is real shameless, not only do they do something wrong and tell you they did something wrong, but they'll look you right in the eye. You know how we do that? We'll say, how could you look me in the eye and say that? Like, how could you not at least have the decency to like hang your head? Well, this tax collector can't bring himself to look God in the eye. Not because he mistrusts God's goodness, but because he's fully aware of his fallenness. Jesus says in Luke 18, this next phrase, he would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast. This is an extraordinary act. The breast was a part of the body that was regarded as particularly significant in the ancient times. So because it housed the heart, and it was considered a location of the truest and deepest part of you. It was like the core of who you are. So this act of beating on his breast was an expression of extreme anguish. It was never done in the Old Testament. It's not mentioned at all in the Old Testament. It's recorded only twice in the New Testament. Once is here, and the other time is at Golgotha during the crucifixion of Jesus. The tax collector is making a cry of desperate agony here. My heart is wrong. My heart is wrong at the deepest level. Now, I don't know the truth about anyone's heart in here. There's really only one heart that I can see, and that's mine. I can't see into your heart. I have access to my own mind. I have access to my own secret thoughts and desires. And sometimes, to be honest with you, they frighten me. I heard that someone I used to compete with professionally didn't get a promotion that they were going after. And first of all, just the fact that I would even have a category like that, that I would compete with professionally as a pastor, probably tells you a little bit about my heart. But somewhere along the way, that's what I turned it into. And when I heard this news, I hate to admit it, but there was this like tiny flicker inside of me, and it wasn't compassion. It wasn't sadness. It was relief. It was relief that he wouldn't move ahead of me. That's my heart. You know, I'll get a very clear prompting. Don't say that. It's self-serving. Its only goal is to promote yourself. Don't say it. And I'll say it anyway. I get mad at someone and I find, without even like wanting to, in my imagination, I'm having this conversation, this fantasized conversation where I make these real brilliant, bold statements and arguments that make the other person crumble up in like guilt and shame. Anyone here ever do that in your imagination? But then in real life, I don't say anything at all. Like I just sit there with like this inner resentment because it's easier to do that or because I'm afraid. I don't know. I have things like that. And sometimes I have much worse things that go on in my heart. There's only one person whose depravity I have full access to, and that's mine. That's why pride is so lethal. It blinds me to the truth about myself. It doesn't just influence me, it hijacks my self-awareness. And then I'm not able to repent, and then I'm not able to love. And here's what I'm learning, and this is where the good news comes in. All I have to do in those dark moments, in those dark thoughts, is do what the tax collector did. I just need to stop, and I just need to say the tax collector's prayer. That's how you take the wheel back. And the tax collector prayed, God, I'm a mess. That's his prayer. God, I'm a mess. And that's not the whole truth about me, but that certainly is the truth about me. And if you don't remember anything else from this entire message, it would be a good thing to remember that prayer because you're going to need it sometimes. God, I'm a mess. And you've got to get the pronoun right. God, I'm a mess. Not God, you're a mess. He's a mess. She's a mess. It's about me. God, have mercy on me. I need help. And God will say, I know. I know all about you. Now I'm going to extend you my grace, and I'm going to give you my power that is available to you so that you can live a humble life. You know, we live by grace. Grace isn't just something that we happen to receive because of forgiveness as a Christian. Like every moment of your life, when you mess up, you need grace. When you're not messing up, when you're getting it right, it's because God is sending the Spirit to partner with you and to flood you with ideas and power and strength. And that's grace. That's grace. It's all grace. The tax collector throws himself into the grace of God. And Jesus says, the service is over. The atonement has been offered. The prayers have been prayed. And these two men go home. And this Pharisee, who has spent his whole life in the spiritual winner's circle, he goes home blind and unloving and a million miles away from God. And he doesn't even know it because pride has been driving his whole life. And this tax collector, who has spent his whole life despised and rejected and is in like the spiritual loser circle, this tax collector goes home living in the presence and the power and the grace of God. Humility put God back in the driver's seat. And things were okay. Things are right between him and God. He's justified. He's forgiving. He's forgiven. He's living in
the Spirit, which circle do you want to be in? You know, I know there are so many, like, extremely gifted people in this church. But I think sometimes, you know, if I were the evil one and I wanted to damage this community, the first weapon I would choose would probably not be resentment or anxiety or desire. It would be pride. That's what I would use. And so I just want to take a few moments just before God, just allow the Holy Spirit to work in your life, in your mind right now. If there's anywhere that you need to talk to God about this issue of pride in your life, if there's any part of this Pharisee in you, if there's any pride, if there's any judgmentalism, if there's any superiority, any critical spirit inside of you, any enjoyment in you, you know, thinking about the flaws of other people, any attempt to compare yourself to someone else, just let God know. Just open yourself up to Him. Just pray to Him. Just, God, I don't want to be that kind of person. Here it is. This is me. He sees it anyway. God, I don't want to do that to your church. If there's any of that in you, would you just tell God right now? Just ask Him to give you a humble spirit. All right, would you pray with me as the worship team comes to lead us in a closing song? God, we just confess that pride is the hardest thing for us to see. Like, we feel anger, we feel worry, we feel desire, but pride just makes us feel like we're right. And so often while we're thinking we're praying, or we think we're serving, or think we're growing or whatever, it's like pride is just driving our lives. So God, would you just forgive us for the times when we compare ourselves, forgive us for those secret satisfactions that we feel when other people stumble. Forgive us for the subtle ways that we look down on other people. God, we don't want to do those kinds of things. We don't want to do things that cut us off from your Spirit leading our lives. We don't want to live our lives completely blind. So would you teach us, God, teach us how to say this simple prayer, God, I'm a mess. God, would you have mercy on me? Would you give us the courage to own what's in our hearts? And give us the humility to just open up our lives to you. God, we want to put you back at the center of our lives. We want you to take the wheel of our lives. We want you to drive. We want our lives to be marked not by superiority, but by humility and grace. And so we ask for all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Hey, once again, thanks for listening. We hope you found something in this week's message to take away and apply to your life this week. If you live in the Bay Area, we would love to have you join us for one of our weekend services. For directions or information about what we have for you or your family, your students, you can go to blueoaks.church or download the app today. And we hope to see you on Sunday soon.